Yo, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. More uncertainty about Enbridge Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac.
The integrity of it is quite questionable, even before it had an anchor strike.
Democratic gubernatorial candidate Sri Tanadar has no regrets about posting a photo of himself eating fried chicken just before speaking to a black group.
Look, I eat at Popeye's Chicken many times, and I love spicy chicken. I ate there. I don't see a problem with that.
Then privacy experts say Michigan State University is not being transparent about sexual assault cases.
That goes all the way up to the top at Michigan State, where they make a lot of their board decisions behind closed doors and in secret meetings.
And a short film set in Detroit translates a mother's intense personal story to the screen.
But at the end of it, the audience has to ask themselves, do I see a mother or do I see a heroin addict?
All that and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up later in the hour, we conclude our series of interviews with the Democratic candidates for governor. Today, Ann Arbor businessman Sri Tanadar. But first, there's been more than a little concern regarding Enbridge's oil and gas pipeline known as Line 5. It crosses under the Mackinac Straits near the Mighty Mack Bridge, and it's more than 60 years old. Some of its protective coating is missing. There's been some interior corrosion, but Enbridge says Line 5 is safe. And last week, we learned vessel activity, presumably an anchor strike, damaged submerged electrical cables nearby, and also dented Line 5 in three spots. Enbridge, which we'll remind you is a sponsor of the station, insists those dents are small and are no threat to the pipeline. Governor Snyder wants Line 5 to be decommissioned and for Enbridge to tunnel far below the Straits if it wants a replacement pipeline. Joining us now is Mike Schreiberg. He's the executive director of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center. Hey, welcome again.
Thanks for having me.
I understand you're also on the Michigan Pipeline Safety Advisory Board, right?
That's correct.
So you know something about this stuff. How does tunneling under the Mackinac Straits for replacement Line 5, as Governor Snyder suggests, solve the problem?
Well, I don't think it does. I think that kicks the can down the road here. Just remember, we have infrastructure that is way past its design life. It's in its 65th year. It was designed for 50 years. The integrity of it is quite questionable, even before it had an anchor strike. What we actually need is an immediate stoppage of oil flowing under the Straits till we're 100% sure it's safe. Then we start thinking about the alternatives to Line 5. And, you know, you think about things about what little service Line 5 actually provides to the state of Michigan, and you can find clear alternatives to that.
It says, you know, besides funneling some of that oil to the Marathon refinery in Detroit, that it supplies a great deal of LP gas in the UP. Has anybody been able to verify that?
Well, it's good you should ask that. That has not been well verified, or at least the alternatives to that. In fact, the C.S. Mott Foundation just invested in an independent analysis that would actually look at what some of the alternatives for propane supply are. So that's coming this way. We know it's a solvable problem. The key is to put the right options in front of decision makers. That hasn't happened quite yet.
So that argument by some environmental groups that this is just a shortcut from Canada to Canada through Michigan, is that valid?
Well, yes. Very little of the product is actually utilized within the state of Michigan. So there are solvable problems in that there is some amount that is used in the state, but there are good alternatives. And we're really invested in making sure that those alternatives get to the governor and the attorney general.
So Michigan is not dependent on this line.
This is definitely not critical energy infrastructure. And you have to think about that and balance the existential risk to the Great Lakes with a small amount of benefits that we know that there are alternatives to.
So there's talk about this tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac, which is, what, 5 miles or more, and then tunnel under the St. Clair River to make it safer because it's going through there too, to avoid things like anchor strikes from vessels or, you know, a corrosion leak or something like that. But even if you do that, the whole length of Line 5 lies within the Great Lakes Basin, the watershed of the Great Lakes. Have we really safeguarded anything?
Well, I think not. I mean, there are problems all the way along Line 5. The Straits is probably the most dramatic example of that. But if you look at Line 5 all the way through, there are risks. In fact, there's a long section that parallels US 2 in the Upper Peninsula, that beautiful stretch that you get to just when you cross over. The line is within a mile or two of the lake right there, and there's some sections that are badly in need of repair. So the Straits are sort of exhibit A, but there are risks all the way along Line 5.
We had this inland leak at Marshall, which really messed up the Kalamazoo River and also a pipeline that was owned by Enbridge. Is that an example of something that could happen anywhere along Line 5?
Absolutely. That's an example that was caused by corrosion.
and frankly, it was caused by mismanagement by Enbridge. We have a problem right now in that Enbridge has told us this line is safe under the Straits, even though it's had anchor strikes, even though we know some of the coding is missing. Enbridge has misinformed the public before about that. So the question is, do we trust this company? Do we trust this company with a poor track record with 20% of the world's surface freshwater and the most important resource that Michigan has?
So what would you advise the governor or advise Attorney General Bill Schuette?
Yeah, two steps. One, immediately stop the flow of oil until it's independently verified that Line 5 is safe. The anchor strikes, the coating, all those issues. Second, move immediately to begin decommissioning Line 5 and actually using the feasible alternatives for that small amount of service that's provided. It's simply not worth the risk for our state and our economy.
Mike Schreiberg is Executive Director for the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center. He's also on the Michigan Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
President Donald Trump wants to renegotiate or possibly scrap the North American Free Trade Agreement. There were rumors that details of a new deal might be hashed out this weekend in Peru, where the Summit of the Americas is taking place. But the president has already backed out of attending, and just yesterday his top NAFTA negotiator also canceled his plans to attend the summit. The University of Michigan's Economic Forecasting Unit has been looking at a couple of scenarios regarding NAFTA and the impact on the Michigan economy. Joining me now is Gabriel Ehrlich. He's the director of the Research Seminar in Quantitative Economics. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Let's get an update on NAFTA first. Mexico, Canada, and the United States have been involved in a few rounds of talks. Are we still talking?
We are still talking. We've had several rounds of negotiations so far.
Why does President Trump feel the U.S. is being treated unfairly by NAFTA?
Well, I think the Trump administration looks at jobs, and in particular, the fact that the United States has lost so many manufacturing jobs since NAFTA came into force.
Is that caused by, or is that just correlation with?
Certainly, the downtrend in U.S. manufacturing employment predates NAFTA. You know, the research that I have looked at and I find to be the most credible actually suggests that trade with China has been a much bigger impact on employment in the United States manufacturing industry than NAFTA.
Let's talk about your research. What questions were you trying to answer regarding NAFTA?
Well, we were most importantly focused on the effects of NAFTA on the Michigan economy, and in particular, what would happen to Michigan's economy if the United States were to withdraw from NAFTA.
Now, you looked at a couple of scenarios. Why don't you tell us about those?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just tell you, my unit is an economic forecasting unit at the university, and our primary job is we run statistical models of the United States and Michigan economies. And, you know, one of the interesting challenges of doing this research is that no statistical model can tell you exactly what it would look like if the United States were to withdraw from NAFTA. So we really had to make some assumptions that we thought best bracketed the range of possible outcomes. And so what we did is we modeled what we called a soft withdrawal scenario and a hard withdrawal scenario. And we thought that those two scenarios spanned the range of likely outcomes. The soft withdrawal scenario assumes that the United States withdraws from NAFTA, but there's not really any retaliation from our trade partners. The hard withdrawal scenario assumes that we get into a tit-for-tat, especially with Mexico.
Okay, let's talk about soft withdrawal. Yep. What effect does that have on Michigan's economy if we leave NAFTA and there's no trade fight?
We actually found that Michigan's economy could prosper in that scenario. We actually estimated that in the long run, Michigan could gain about 6,400 jobs. A little over 1,000 of those would be directly in the manufacturing sector. And the reason is that Michigan has a lot of employment in light truck assemblies, which would actually benefit from tariff protection if the United States were to withdraw from NAFTA.
Okay, let's talk about the hard withdrawal. That means somebody, Canada or Mexico or both, retaliate.
Yep. Essentially Mexico in that scenario. And we found that that scenario would be substantially worse for Michigan. We estimated that Michigan would lose about 7,000 jobs in that scenario, about 4,000 of those in the manufacturing sector. So that's really, you know, a more negative outcome.
Let's put these numbers into perspective.
Absolutely.
Since the recession, we've gained a lot of jobs. How does this compare to what you're talking about in lost jobs?
Lester, I actually think that's a great question and it's an important point. Maybe the best way of thinking about this is that Michigan's manufacturing industry actually lost more than 400,000 jobs from 1999 to 2009. So certainly 7,000 jobs is a lot of jobs. The people who are directly affected or would be directly affected would certainly feel that job loss. But, you know, our research suggests that Michigan is actually much better positioned now to withstand a shock from international trade than maybe it was in the past. And so in that sense, we actually thought that you know, there was an optimistic lesson to be drawn from this analysis.
I literally saw two headlines that had completely different takes on your research. One said, quote, Michigan's economy positioned to withstand a NAFTA withdrawal.
Yep.
And another said, report says Michigan economy at risk from ending NAFTA. So which is correct?
You know, I actually think that first interpretation is a little bit more correct. We've certainly seen analyses that are much more pessimistic about Michigan's prospects in the event of a NAFTA withdrawal than our analysis. You know, what we come back to is that economic theory says that free trade increases economic efficiency. And we certainly believe that as well. But the reality is that free trade, international trade, also creates winners and losers in national economies. And in this case, withdrawing from NAFTA would mean substantial tariff protection for one of Michigan's major export industries. And so we actually believe that the blow to Michigan's manufacturing industry wouldn't be quite as large as some other analyses that we've seen.
So like all economics, you economists love to say on the one hand and then on the other hand, because you guys all seem to want to include all these other factors. You looked at two scenarios out of an unlimited number of scenarios. So how confident are you that we'll have one of these outcomes and one 7,000 jobs gained, one 6,000, 7,000 jobs lost?
That's a great question. The answer is we would not expect either one of these scenarios literally to be what would happen if the United States were to withdraw from NAFTA. What we did was we chose these scenarios to try to bracket the range of likely outcomes. So we would expect that the outcome would be somewhere in between these two scenarios. And I should just add, our baseline assumption is still that NAFTA will be renegotiated successfully.
Which brings me to my last question, and that is, given the tariffs the U.S. plans to levy against Chinese imports, China's retaliatory tariffs, the withdrawal from the Pacific Trade Partnership, I mean, really, how surprised would you be if President Trump said, no, we're going to withdraw from NAFTA?
Well, you know, what I've learned covering this issue is if you follow the day-to-day news on this too closely, you're going to get whiplash. So I try not to read too much into any one day's news reports. I think at this point, nothing would shock me. I still expect that the United States will renegotiate this agreement with Canada and Mexico successfully with mostly symbolic changes. I do think that there will be some changes in there that allow the administration to paint this as a win. So I would be surprised but not shocked if we heard that.
Gabriel Ehrlich is the director of the University of Michigan's Economic Forecasting Unit. Thanks for coming in and explaining NAFTA and NAFTA withdrawal.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, did Michigan State University violate a student's privacy this week when addressing a recently filed lawsuit? We'll take a look in about 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Tomorrow, the Grand Rapids Film Festival will screen the short film Detroit Diamond. The film is about a young mother addicted to heroin. The state is working to take away her son.
You've got to bring up all the fight you possibly have in you to fight for this little boy. I know that you want to be a mother to this little boy. Don't you want to fight for him?
Of course I do, Mrs. Roche. I keep thinking I hear him all the time. On the way here, at night alone in my room, at the bus stop, I keep looking over my shoulder expecting him to see him, but he's not there.
Joining me are Hamoudi Jafar, the director, and Michael R. Flores, who wrote Detroit Diamond. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So, Michael, what was your inspiration for writing the script?
It was a true story. It was actually the story of my son's biological mother.
And Hamoudi, I understand you came back to Detroit from L.A. to save up some money and make your own films. Why did this story resonate with you?
So I had made a couple short films when I first moved back home and I was working at Quicken Loans. I'd saved up some money, made a couple shorts. This script in particular really resonated with me because heroin addiction is something that's affected me personally through friends and family members. I lost my cousin in my early 20s, as well as a best friend from high school on the same day to a heroin overdose. So it's always something I've wanted to tell a story about, but I just had never read a script or really, I guess, had the courage on my end to write something. And then when I read Michael's script, it immediately just sort of resonated with me and I knew I had to make it.
This was filmed in Detroit. The cast members are mostly from Detroit. Why?
Well, I think it's important to make anything you create as authentic as possible. So for us, you know, authenticity was definitely a topic we discussed, making sure that we sort of immersed ourselves in the environments that we were filming in and making sure that we had local people that we felt could make it feel real was really important to us.
You chose Detroit's East Side. This is mostly filmed around Mack and Gratiot, which is an area I'm familiar with. Why there?
Visually, the landscape on the east side of Detroit, and then in that area in particular, there's a lot of desolation. It's very gritty. You know, I think
a lot of graffiti, a lot of boarded up windows, things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of folks that suffer from drug addiction that sort of roam those streets. So I think to maintain the authenticity, like we talked about, it was a perfect landscape to shoot in. And I think Michael can add a little bit onto that too.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of gentrification that's going on in Midtown and Cass, and on the outskirts of Detroit have been abandoned a bit. And to bring attention to that area was important for us.
The cast is all female. How intentional was that?
100% intentional. There was actually a male written for one of the characters, and we had talked before, maybe 2 weeks before production, about switching it over to a female, just because it's such a female-centric story. It's about mothers that are kind of ragging on another mother, which is the worst thing you can do.
And just so people know, we're talking about the drug dealer character, and here's a scene from the film.
I don't know what to tell you, homegirl. I ain't taking no old dirty-ass watches right now. Just cash money.
Can you front me one? I gotta go see my kid in like 2 hours at CPS.
Nah.
Come on.
Nuh-uh. No fronts. But we can work something out again. No watches, though. You feel me?
I think it's something that we wanted to make sure we maintain. It was a conversation we actually had, like he just said, right before production. We're like, this is the only role that isn't a female. And can we see it as a female and sort of maintain that consistency, especially of characters in positions of power across the board, being female? And, you know, we got lucky with the casting because we used a local MC. Her name is Ms. Corona, who happened to have some acting chops. And she was in the film 8 Mile. So that really worked out in our favor, and she really held it down and did a great job.
You know what I liked about it? It wasn't stereotypical. Yeah. I mean, it felt authentic because of that. So you got a lot of cooperation from Detroit people who encouraged your project, such as, you know, help with location. How unique is that when you're making a short film?
I've found over the years that it's something people are very open to doing. I think people locally in Detroit, when they hear you're, you know, filming something, they sort of get excited and they want to help collaborate. They want to help contribute to the art scene. We had a guy named Larry Rittner who owned, we got lucky again. I mean, he owns a lot of properties on the east side, and he's taking these properties, and they're blighted out properties that he wants to sort of gut out and rehabilitate. And he was more than happy to sort of help us out and let us use his homes.
So, Michael, this was a personal story to you, very personal, it sounds like. Tell me a little bit about Detroit Diamond. What kind of struggle was she going through?
So the story is about her struggling with her own addiction. It's about people coming at her from different angles, some subtle, some very harsh. But at the end of it, the audience has to ask themselves, do I see a mother or do I see a heroin addict? And so we leave it up to the audience to go through that journey with her without condemning her or without applauding her. And at the end, you'll have to decide for yourself which identity wins.
Michael R. Flores wrote and Hamoudi Jafar directed the short film Detroit Diamond. It plays tomorrow as part of the Grand Rapids Film Festival. Thanks for coming in.
And thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Also tomorrow at the Freep Film Festival, The Registry makes its world premiere. It's about some little-known Asian American history around World War II. Then after the screening, I'll be moderating a panel of the co-directors, which includes Bill Kubota of Detroit Public Television. The Registry shows at 4 p.m. at the Detroit Historical Museum. It's time to check in with our regular Friday commentators, Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican Majority Leader in the State Senate, and Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Governor Snyder says the water in Flint is safe. Time to end bottled water distribution, although the state will continue to distribute water filters to residents. Ken, the lead pipes in Flint have not been replaced, not all of them anyway. People in Flint have heard the state government insist the water is safe in the past. Not a lot of trust left there. What do you think of this decision by Rick Snyder?
Well, so given the fact that you've had 2 years of good test results that comply with the public health standard that everybody else has to comply with, I think it's a good decision and a reasonable decision. Doesn't mean that everybody in Flint's going to be happy about it. I don't think you could use the standard of replacing all the lead pipes, because you've got cities all across the state and the country that have lead pipes. That it has to be a public health standard.
Vicki, some Flint legislators are asking Attorney General Bill Schuette to intervene and restore bottled water distribution in the city. What's likely to happen there?
I'm not a lawyer, so I can't predispose what's going to happen in a lawsuit or asking the Attorney General to intercede. But I can respectfully disagree with my colleague Ken when it comes to the distribution of bottled water. This was a state and an administration that said, we will go in and we will replace all the pipes. And until we replace all the pipes, the water may not be safe. So it was the state that already set this standard of replacing all of the pipes, including all of the older lead pipes, where the corrosive agent was not used. There has been time to build up the new inside protection on those pipes, but it was the governor himself and his administration who said, we're going to replace all the pipes so that you can be sure that the water is clean. So the people don't know who to listen to. Are they supposed to listen to the standards that come out of the lead in their water, or are they supposed to listen to the governor who is finally listening to them and replacing the pipes? I think the water distribution should continue, although I know that it's costly. It's $22,000 a day, but this is something that the state created and the state has to own up to.
Let's change the subject here. The Democrats hold an endorsement convention this weekend in Detroit. The most hotly contested race is for attorney general. Three Democrats, Pat Miles, Dana Nessel, and William Noakes, are running for the party nomination. In recent days, things have gotten pretty nasty between the two frontrunners, Miles and Nessel. Miles is accused of using Republican opposition research against Nessel in this Democratic race. And then yesterday, Miles' campaign accused Nessel of being insensitive to sexual assault victims because of statements she made questioning proposed legislation extending the statute of limits for bringing sexual assault charges. Ken, the Democrats are not alone, of course. Republicans also have a bit of a feud going on between Bill Schuette and Brian Kelly in the race for governor. We'll talk about that someday soon. But I'm wondering, if these primary races are getting this nasty, are they actually doing the opposing party's job for them?
I don't think these races, whether it's the Democratic race for attorney general or the Republican primary for governor, I don't think they're any more or less nasty than other races. I think one of the advantages the Democrats have is that this kind of nastiness is occurring now because of their convention this weekend and the endorsement convention, and it just gives them more time for passions to subside and wounds to heal. But I think this is par for the course.
Vicki, what do you think of your fellow Democrats and the tactics of the campaigns in recent days?
I don't like ugly, dirty campaigns, so I'm disappointed that we've come to this, but it's not unusual in politics that people who are very passionate about candidates start to say things that may not be nice, but that's just the nature of politics. And if you don't have a thick skin, you shouldn't be running for office. And I do think that we're going to have a lively discussion on Sunday at the endorsement convention for the state party. But as Ken said, this is not unusual. It's not unheard of. Of course, it happens all the time. I want to point out to listeners, though, that this is not a primary election. Attorney General and Secretary of State and the candidates that we're going to be looking at are all nominated by Democratic Party members at a state convention.
Yeah, let me ask you about that, because this is confusing to people. The Democrats have this formal nominating convention in August. What exactly is the purpose of this endorsement convention?
Well, apparently, from what I'm hearing, the chair of the Democratic Party, Brandon Dillon, has been able to negotiate a step out of the way agreement between the candidates for attorney general. So at the end of this convention, we should have only one candidate, the endorsed candidate, emerging.
Ken, I should ask you, does this endorsement convention, is that something the Republicans should think about too?
I think it's kind of a smart idea on the part of the Democrats. Like I said earlier, it has an advantage in that this sort of nastiness you're talking about is over, in a sense, by the end of Sunday. And that just gives them, like I said, more time for kind of passions to subside versus the Schuette Kelly race, you know, that goes till the August primary.
Vicki, this is just a handshake agreement, right? Somebody gets the endorsement and the others will voluntarily step aside?
That's my understanding. We've done this before. It's not binding, of course, but I think there is an agreement among Dems that the longer time we have to campaign with our ticket, the better off we are. And as Ken pointed out, the quicker the passions on both sides can coalesce and come to agreement and support the candidate that emerges on Sunday.
That is Vicki Barnett, a former Democratic legislator, and we heard from Ken Sikkema, a former Republican legislator. Hey, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lester.
Michigan State University seems to have used private statements between a student and a counselor and press release to the public. David Jesse with the Free Press outlines the detail in a story published yesterday. Here's the timeline, though. Monday, a former student filed a lawsuit in federal court. That suit claims back in 2015, three Michigan State basketball players raped the student. It alleges the student was discouraged by university personnel from reporting the incident to police. On Wednesday, MSU officials issued a statement denying the allegations and then proceeded to reveal when the student visited the counseling center and included details about what counselors advised. Joining me now is Frank Lamonte. He's a professor and director of the Brechner Center for Freedom of Information at the University of Florida. He was quoted in that Free Press story. What's the problem with Michigan State University's statement?
The question is whether the Michigan State has engaged in a release of what is called educational records or the content of educational records. There's a federal privacy law known as FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, that requires educational institutions to maintain the confidentiality of what the feds describe as education records. So if those counseling records, if the information about the advice that she received from counselors qualifies as education records, and if those records are traceable back to an identifiable individual person, then Michigan State could be in violation of that federal privacy law.
Well, the university says it has the right to use the information to defend itself under the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, and it notes it did not use the student's name. So what's the concern?
Well, there is an exemption in the FERPA statute for the use of student education records when that is necessary to defend a university, but it specifically says in the statute that you are entitled to use those when you go to court. In other words, you can introduce those records as an exhibit or as evidence in a court proceeding, but this appears to be a disclosure not directly to the court, but to the news media, and that puts it into a grayer area. There's a lot of disagreement about the boundaries of what does and does not qualify as an education record, but interestingly, universities generally call this strike zone very narrowly in against disclosure and in favor of confidentiality when it suits their interest to do that. And so if a reporter had shown up and asked for these very same documents under the Michigan Public Records Act, there is every chance in the world that the university would have said you cannot have those because of FERPA. So it's just interesting, and I would venture a tad hypocritical to see an institution calling a different strike zone when it suits their purposes for protection of their image.
How unusual is it to release this kind of information to the public?
It's quite unusual. In fact, there are universities around the country that are fighting to withhold very comparable information, including two of them, Western Kentucky and the University of Kentucky. They're in court right now actually suing journalists to try to stop the disclosure of very comparable sets of information, again, with identities removed. And in those cases, they are arguing that even with names removed, it is possible for some person in the community to perform some detective work and match those records up to an individual, and that makes them, in the views of those universities, FERPA records. So I think the prevailing sentiment would be if you asked a university legal counsel around the country, can you disclose records of this kind about a specific individual that details their counseling history? I think the prevailing interpretation from university counsels would be absolutely not.
Michigan State University is already being criticized by child sex abuser Larry Nassar's survivors for fostering a culture that is insensitive towards sexual assault victims. Now we've got this public release of private statements between a student and counselor. What does this tell you about the culture of leadership at Michigan State?
Well, going back over the history of the Nassar case, what you have seen time and time again is a culture of secrecy and concealment. That goes all the way up to the top at Michigan State, where they make a lot of their board decisions behind closed doors in secret meetings. And so it's sort of ironic that the one time that Michigan State decides to depart from that tradition of secrecy and concealment is when it suits their purposes to rebut the claims of a sexual assault victim.
So what kind of advice would you give to Michigan State University officials?
I would probably say that you need a top-to-bottom readjustment in your culture, and that includes getting some better advice about what does and does not qualify as confidential. Michigan State has lost in court several times when they have been challenged on their over-application of privacy law to withhold things like police reports that involve misconduct by student athletes. And so they have applied privacy as sort of a sword and as a shield when it suits their purposes to do so. And I would say that whatever advice they are getting about their interpretation of privacy law is not serving them very well.
Frank Lamonti is professor and director of the Brechner Center for Freedom of Information at the University of Florida. He was quoted in a free press report by David Jesse. That article is titled, "Michigan State's Rape Lawsuit Statement Likely Violated Privacy Laws." Thanks very much for explaining all this to us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Still to come, we finish off our series of interviews with Democratic candidates for governor. Ann Arbor businessman Tree Tanador joins us next. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, we've been talking to Democrats running for their party's nomination for governor. Today, we talk to Sri Tanador, an Ann Arbor businessman who is primarily self-funding his campaign. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester.
We've been asking all the candidates about a handful of important issues, so we might as well just get started on the list. First, education. Average student test scores keep going down in Michigan. We're losing ground to other states. How do we do better for our students?
Well, you know me. I grew up in poverty. And education was a ladder for my success. And that ladder is broken for too many Michiganders. And we got to work on that because that's where we give skill sets to people to do good for themselves. So certainly we need to invest more in K-12. We need to pay our teachers well. We need to hire more teachers. We need to have more support staff. I want to focus on universal pre-K, so the children in their early childhood. And I have a grandson who is 15 months old. And I can see how the young children learn at their early age. So we need to have a robust learning right at the early age of, say, maybe 15 months to 2 years.
But how do you pay for that?
Well, there is a number of ways we can pay for. I am for recreational marijuana. That would generate about $125 million.
Which is not going to go very far to fix the schools.
Yes, but there's need to be more. I want to do a graduated tax structure. Many progressive states, many successful states have graduated tax structure. I want to change the 4.25 flat rate that we have and raise it up. I don't want to raise any taxes for the lower middle income, middle class or lower middle class, or the working poor, but the rich, the ultra-rich, and the corporations should pay their fair share.
That would require a change of the Michigan Constitution. How do you do that? You can't do it as governor.
I understand, but we will have to have a proposal, and we need to have that voted by the people of Michigan. But I would lead that. I would support that. You know, Republicans have not invested in our state. They haven't invested in our education. They haven't invested enough into our infrastructure. And we can become the state, the great state that we want to be. We can't take Michigan to the top unless we invest in our people. So I want to bring vocational training, career technical education in middle school and in high schools. I want to make colleges, public universities tuition free. And I want to start out with making any family that makes $120,000 or less should not have to pay tuition for 2-year college or 4-year college, community college or public universities.
The state is in good times right now, and we're struggling with, well, we'll talk about roads in a second. We're due for an economic downturn. How are you going to accomplish this if that economic downturn would happen within your first term?
Well, we got to invest. If we don't invest, then we're going to go to the route of Mississippi. And all this trickle-down economics has not worked. And it is time that we generate revenues, whether we go to federal government and get our fair share of revenues to expand, say, 94 or put a new SULAC. There is money that can be had from federal government.
Let's talk about infrastructure, the roads primarily. Despite an increase in the gasoline tax and higher registration fees, the roads are not improving. What would you do about roads, bridges, and other infrastructure?
Well, our roads are a joke. I mean, they're the worst in the nation. The potholes are becoming so downright dangerous. The other day, I was going to a gubernatorial debate, and I was at Woodward and Jefferson, and my front tire goes flat, and then my second tire goes flat. And I got a tow truck come in, take the car away, and I got an Uber just in time to get at the debate. You know, Michiganders are spending over $500 a year on car repairs. Together, we're spending about $2.5 billion. We got to fix the roads. And again, there, what I would do is municipal bonds, 30-year statewide municipal bonds, but we need to put somewhere between $4 billion to $6 billion. Every study that I have seen is looking for that kind of investment in our state. I want to change the focus. Snyder, for the last 7 years, has focused on big corporate welfare. We need to work on investing in more small businesses, which create most of our jobs, and get away from the big corporate incentives. I want to make sure that the corporations pay their fair share of taxes.
Let's talk about a real hot debate right now. In the wake of the Parkland, Florida mass shooting, the gun debate has risen to the top of political issues. What's your position on guns?
Well, I'm a supporter of Second Amendment, but I would want gun ownership, a responsible gun ownership. What does that mean is that I absolutely want no guns in education institutions. I think it's a bad idea to give guns to the teachers. A teacher's primary job is to teach, and I don't want teachers to be carrying guns. We need to bring better security, use technology to make our schools safer. Invest in our schools so we have safety personnel to provide safeguard. You know, my grandchild, I worry about when he goes to school, you know, as a parent, you don't want to hear that bad news that something has happened in your son's or your daughter's school. So we need to make our schools safer. But if that means key card access, if that means more security, if that means more technology, we should do that and we should invest and we should have the money to invest in K-12 to ensure that our children can learn in a safe environment and our teachers can teach in a safe environment.
Background checks?
Absolutely. We need to have a thorough background checks.
It's also been proposed an assault weapon ban.
I support that.
How do you define assault weapons?
Semi-automatic, anything that...
there are a lot of hunting rifles out there that are semi-automatic.
We need to look into that, but we don't need any military-style assault weapons for people to go hunting and game and support protecting themselves.
So this AR-15 is used a lot in these mass shootings, but when you look at the statistics, more people die from handguns than these type of military rifles. What would you do about handguns?
We need to keep guns away from things like domestic abusers. If someone has a record of domestic abuse, that person should not get guns.
I guess what I'm asking, if you're wanting to ban assault weapons, why not ban handguns?
Well, we need to take a look at it, but we need to have a dialogue. We need to have a sensible policy here, and we need to balance people's right to own guns and people's right to protect themselves and people's right to do the hunting and game. At the same time, we do not have military-style assault weapons for Second Amendment.
Let's go to this next topic, healthcare. You're in favor of a single-payer system. As governor, how would you accomplish that goal?
Well, the best thing to do is to have it at a national level. And as a governor, I'll use my position to work with the congressional delegation to make that happen at a national level. If that cannot be done, we should expand Medicare. Maybe we can start out with children that are 18 years of old or younger. And
It's still a federal program, though. I mean,
you're
not going to be able to do that at the state level.
It is. But we eventually we need to work on this because, you know, countries that are less fortunate than us are able to take care of health care of their citizens. And United States should be able to do that. People shouldn't have to be worried about their health care. People shouldn't have to worry that if there is a catastrophic illness that they're going to go bankrupt.
I want to talk to you about some unflattering coverage you've been getting from the national media. Let's talk about some of those articles. Several outlets were aghast at a photo you posted of yourself eating Popeye's chicken just before a debate before the Black Caucus. Why did you think that was a good idea?
Well, look, recent polls have shown that this has become a two-person race. And now I am neck and neck with...
That doesn't answer my question, though.
I know, I will. So basically what I've seen is since I was 3 points ahead in the poll, I started getting these attacks. Look, I eat at Popeye's chicken many times, and I loved spicy chicken. I ate there. I don't see a problem with that. There are some issues.
You can see the optics, though. You know, it's a stereotypical racist type thing that Black people like chicken more than other people.
Well, look, I am not a career politician. Typically, a career politician spend all their life looking good and being politically right. I live my life. I am what I am. And, you know, as opposed to, you know, we see all the scripted politicians that look good and act good and all that fakeness, and we're tired of it. Michiganders are tired of the career politicians. We need people that can act and make things happen.
Do you regret posting that picture?
No, absolutely not.
The Intercept published two articles about you. One headline read, Michigan gubernatorial candidate brands himself as the Bernie, meaning Bernie Sanders, of the race, but he donated to Clinton and McCain. The second headline read, a Bernie-branded millionaire is leading the Democratic race for governor. He almost ran as a Republican, consultants say. You want to respond to those stories about
you? Yes. There's a couple consultants, Democratic consultants, that I talked to. You know, these people didn't get hired. One got hired and he tried to, we ended up parting ways. And the other guy I did not hire. And these people, because they didn't get my money, started spreading rumors. None of that.
Is it true that you donated to Clinton and McCain?
Yeah, I donated $32,000 to various political candidates because, you know, because I'm a man of wealth, I get calls. And Hillary Clinton's campaign called. And a lot of times these donations are based on an invitation to go to a fundraiser. And this is just a ticket price to go in there. It is not an endorsement of these candidates, but I get a chance to ask questions to the candidates. And these opportunities allow me to do that, so it should not be looked at as an endorsement. But out of the $32,000 that I've donated, I have donated only $2,300 to one Republican candidate, John McCain. Rest of the money was donated to Democrats. And I'm a lifelong Democrat.
Were you considering running as a Republican, as this suggests?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I am, you know, pro-choice. I am strong. My social positions are so strong. I'm a big supporter of LGBTQ community. There is absolutely no way that I could ever run as a Republican.
I'm glad you brought that up about the different causes that you support, because you describe yourself again and again in the videos and ads and stuff as the most progressive of the Democratic candidates. What have you done politically to justify that claim?
Well, you know, I have lived the most progressive life. I grew up in poverty. I'm the only gubernatorial candidate that knows what it feels like going to bed hungry. I did not come from privilege like my opponents have. And I have lived a progressive life, and I have never paid anyone less than $15 an hour when I ran small businesses. And, you know, I've been fair to my employees. I have given them health care. I have given them. So my talk is not just talking points. This is how I have lived. So I understand how Michiganders live. 22% of Michiganders live below poverty line. 40% of African-American children live in poverty. And I have lived that life.
The Detroit News ran a story about you late last month. It reported one of your former employees quit the company that you own because you refused to alert federal regulators to a customer who was suspected of illegally spiking a male herbal supplement with prescription Viagra. That's a pretty serious accusation. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, I'm a private company. I'm just like a psychiatrist or a doctor. So if a patient goes to a psychiatrist and talks about something, the psychiatrist don't go and call police on the patient.
This is a different situation than that, though. This is something that you were analyzing. You were asked to analyze it and you found that it was spiked with Viagra.
Yeah, yeah. Let me explain that. So when the customer came to me, he had a herbal supplement that he either was manufacturing or he was distributing. I don't know all the details. Or has he sold it? I don't know. So he brings it to me and says, Shree, analyze this and see if you find anything bad in it. My lab did the analysis, and it is my lab that found Viagra in that product. And then we basically told the customer, hey, if you intend to sell this, you cannot, because there are laws about it. One of them are patent laws.
But somebody was making that, and didn't you have an obligation to tell the FDA,
no,
this is being manufactured?
I don't know who is manufacturing that. And basically, I'm a fee-for-service. A customer comes to me. So next time a psychiatrist starts turning his patients
You can mention psychiatrists, but there are guidelines in set. Is there a guideline that says you can't?
Yeah. Nobody in my industry does that. So this accusation was totally wrong, and someone was trying to, again, smear me because I'm up in the polls. But our industry, testing industry, this is a fee-for-service. A client comes to you, gets things analyzed. You report that to the client, and you do an analysis that accurate, and you are totally transparent with the customer. And we told the customer that this would be illegal if you chose to sell this. But I do not know if he's selling it. I do not know if he's manufacturing it. All the customer asked me to do is find out what's in it, and I found that out. I told him. And then I expect the mom to do the right thing. I expect this customer to do the right thing. But I did tell them that it's illegal for them to sell it.
You've mentioned several times now that you feel you're being smeared because you're up in the polls. Who do you think is smearing you?
I don't know. Some cases I have seen other candidates have published or put together flyers with their paid for by. Some cases there are text messages that have been sent out smearing me. And
isn't that part of the rough and tumble of political life?
It is part of that. And I'm tough. And so when I entered this race, I told my family, this is going to get rough. Fasten your seat belts. I have a thick enough a skin that I don't need to wake up at 3 a.m. and tweet. But I understand that. I expect that. But, I'm trying to run an issue-based campaign. I just announced put on television, seven new commercials.
Right. You're spending $1 million in the next 60 days.
Exactly. But every of that commercial, if you look at it, is issue-based. I could have used the same money to attack my opponents, but I chose not to because I'm running a clean campaign. And, I am in politics not because this is what I need to make my resume look good. I'm very proud of my resume. I'm doing this because I want to change Michigan. I want to, take Michigan to the next level. And so I won't be worried about my reelection. I won't be worried about anything. Only thing I'll be worried about is doing the right thing. And for that, I have taken a pledge not to take a single penny from corporate special interest. And so I'll go there beholden to no one except the people of Michigan.
Shree Tanadhar is running for the Democratic nomination for governor of Michigan. Thanks for coming in again.
You're welcome, Lester. Thanks for inviting me.
Hey, I wanted to remind you, on Thursday, May 3rd, we'll be producing Stateside in front of a live audience at Celebration Cinemas North in Grand Rapids. And we want your help to produce the show. What kind of stories from Grand Rapids do you think we should be doing and sharing with the rest of the state? What issues do you think we need to cover? Are there unsung heroes or people from Grand Rapids you think we ought to talk to? Let us know. Leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. Again, that number, 734-764-7840. Or leave your idea and learn more about the event at the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock, who gave today's Stateside show 2 thumbs up. Whoa.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Joy Horan, and Danny Hensel. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.